I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Linda Durham. She was a longtime art gallery owner and is a freelance cultural explorer, as she calls herself. And Friday night at 5:30 at the St. Francis Auditorium tomorrow, she will be giving a talk called Wonderlust, Linda Durham's 30 Fearless Years in the Art World. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So how did you start in this business?
I started with some very important personal characteristics, naivete, optimism, and a sense of adventure.
And probably a love of art and a very good eye.
No, those actually I did not have in the beginning. Curiosity I definitely had. I worked for Forrest Fenn for a year as his director of research, and worked with the kind of art that he was showing. And at the same time, I had all sorts of personal friends who were artists but who did not have a place in Santa Fe to show their work. We're talking about the 70s, the late 70s.
Right.
And while I was working at the Fenn Gallery, I kept thinking of all the things I would do if I had a gallery or if I were showing artwork. And and after a year, I left the gallery, Fenn's gallery, happily and in a good way. And I had a friend who said, well, you know, why don't you open your own gallery? Well, I didn't know how, but I had a lot of friends who made art, and I had a sense of adventure and a desire to travel. And so I thought, I would like to do an exhibition on the road. I would like to take art around the world. So my first project was to take a show to Toronto. And I didn't have any access to the kind of work that Forrest showed. But I did have access to the work of a lot of wonderful artists locally. So I did an exhibition called New Mexico in Toronto.
Nice.
Yeah. And
what kind of work was it? Was it recognizably New Mexican, like landscapes and things like that?
I'll tell you, I had a couple of pieces by Georgia O'Keeffe. I had work by a lot of artists who are now very familiar around here. John Fincher, Paul Sarkisian, John Wenger, Alan Graham, Carol Mothner, over 30 artists. And I didn't know what I was doing. I had beginner's luck. And it's a story I'm going to tell more on Friday.
Yeah, yeah. Now, so, and it did well.
Oh, no. I borrowed money to do the show, and I had some very good luck because I met a famous art collector in Toronto, and he bought some artwork. But no, I lost $15,000.
Oh, my goodness.
And I lost $15,000 that I didn't own, $15,000 of borrowed money. And so, but I had like instant credibility. Larry Bell and Ken Price were in that show, and they all put it on their resumes. You know, it was New Mexico in Toronto. Sounds like a big show. And then I had an opportunity to do a show in San Francisco, New Mexico, in the Bay Area, that was sponsored by Syntec Corporation, but suggested by the Friends of Stanford University. And then the third show I did was in Edinburgh with the Edinburgh Festival of the Arts. So I didn't know anything, but I guess I had a steep learning curve, and I was off.
It's interesting because, I mean, when you are in a place like New Mexico, you can do a show called New Mexico in Toronto. It'd be harder to do a show called New Jersey in Toronto or something like that.
No, I'm from New Jersey.
I know, that's why I said that.
So, yeah, I think so. But back then, there weren't the big art fairs. There weren't as many art magazines. There was room to make things happen, and there was curiosity among a lot of people who did like the art world or who were inclined to investigate the art world.
So what was the art world, the art scene like, or just like there were lots of young artists living in Santa Fe working? I mean, paint a picture for us.
There were young and old artists, and the people who were working quietly and sincerely. Most of the people I knew in the beginning were people who wanted to make art more than anything else. It's not like, well, I want to have a career in the art world. It's, I am an artist. I want to show my work. I want to find out how to show my work. And some of the first artists I represented, once I got the gallery on Canyon Road, Alan Graham, Richard Hogan, a lot of people who came out of the University of New Mexico, Constance DeYoung, Timothy App.
And, I mean, the title of your lecture is has the word fearless in it, which I love, Linda Durham's 30 Fearless Years in the Art World. I mean, you know, the way you talk about it, you start out, you do this show, you meet people, you lose $15,000 of somebody else's money. It must have been a little scary.
I don't think so. I could picture the way I wanted it to be, and I was enthusiastic about possibilities. And from childhood, and this sounds a little silly, I had these two slogans. One came from a book called Poems That Touch the Heart. The world would stop if it were run by those who say it can't be done. A jingle. But it stuck with me that was true. And the other is the well-known Goethe quote, whatever you can do, a dream you can, begin it. And that was it. I think in retrospect, it was a little bit like those old Mickey Rooney movies where it's, let's have a play, you know, my mom will make the costumes and
right,
we'll
right.
go in the garage. And although I didn't know very much and I didn't have any money, intuition played a good part for me. I knew who knew intuitively, and I listened, and I learned a lot from people who were serious about art, who did look and see far better than I did, or that I knew one could.
Did people act as kind of mentors for you?
Oh, absolutely. Paul Sarkisian was an early mentor. Alan Graham was a good mentor for me. I had a couple of art dealers in New York who helped me a lot, and other artists. Just my love for the artistic personality, the artist's personality, was great, and so I spent so much time in artist studios, or not just looking at artwork and talking about art, but how does an artist live? And what do people who have at the center of their being the desire to create, what do they do? How do they raise their children? Where do they live? What do they eat?
Were there any common answers?
No, but I formed some opinions or some taste about what I liked and why I thought this art over that art or this artist more than that artist. With regard to artists, I could recognize those who had tapped deeply into their own creative well. And I listened. I looked at that work. You know, early on, I went into a gallery that doesn't exist now and hasn't for over 30 years. And there was a painting by Eugene Newman. This was before, long before I represented him. And it was an abstract, non-representational kind of work. And I was looking at it, and the dealer came up to me and said, you know, may I answer a question? And I asked the question that dealers always make fun of. I said, what's that supposed to mean? And he said, usually when people ask me that, I tell them, if you can't see it, I don't have time for you. But, you know, it's a quiet day and you're a lovely woman. And so he talked to me about the painting.
No, he actually prefaced it with that?
He did. He said that to me. I was mortified. And so in my years, I would never do that to anyone. And because it is a question that people who aren't steeped in art and the art world might want to answer. When the gallery was on Canyon Road once, I had a guy come in to do some electrical work or plumbing work, and he was there for hours. And as he was leaving, he looked at some of the art on the wall, and he said to me, wow, that painting looks like electric worms. And I said, oh, I see what you mean. He said, I'm right? I said, well, I can get that. He said, this one over here, that looks like outer space. And I said, yeah, it could. I can see how you see that. The next day was a Saturday, and he came back with a friend. And they went from painting to painting, looking and talking and having fun. And I think it's because they had permission to be right or to be okay and not intimidated.
Well, it's one of the things about galleries and museums is that whether inadvertently or on purpose, they can set up barriers where people who feel that they're not educated or in the know or part of the in-group or whatever feel excluded.
Yes. And so I know that one of my passions in life, and it's been a passion since pre-kindergarten, is communication, conversation, strangers. Just love, who are you?
Yeah.
Wow, you're interesting. Look how you're dressed. And so that actually became a part of what the gallery was about. My interest in talking with everyone who came in or anyone who came in and talking about what was on the walls and what was in their minds.
We're talking to Linda Durham, owner of the Linda Durham Gallery for so many years. Now, you talked a moment ago about how you came to really recognize art that went very deep, where people were drawing on the well of their experience and feeling and so on. The art gallery business is a business. Did that work tend to sell better than work that was maybe more trendy or clever?
Probably not. I don't know for sure. And it's that I could sense that in the artist, in the creator, and that made me want to look at that art better. So first, I had a sense that this must be good. Then I had a sense of let me look at it. And as time went on, I got better and better at figuring out what I liked and why, and also finding a way to explain it to other people. And I just met more people. I met lots of people who came in, and they already knew something that I was just learning. So,
to what extent was the business at that time competitive? So, let's say you're on Canyon Road, and everybody's an art gallerist, and it's a community, obviously, because you all know each other, and you're all doing the same thing. But there must also have been some pretty intense competition.
Aha, but in the late 70s and early 80s, Canyon Road had a very different look.
Uh-huh.
And actual people and families lived in those houses. And it wasn't gallery after gallery. There were very, very few galleries on Canyon Road in the beginning. And that made it possible for me to do what I was doing. starting out today, being optimistic and naive and intuitive, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So I think I was at the right place at the right time in order to find my way into my passion and a 30-year career.
It is very interesting that, I mean, somebody with the qualities that you have that really did make for a very good gallery and a lot of interesting work and the ability to support a lot of good artists, and those qualities don't work today. And I remember once hearing Jane Goodall say, I mean, one of the greatest scientists of all time, that if she'd been a lot younger and had the same qualities that she had, namely patience and curiosity and observational ability and all of that, the way the world is set up today, she would never have become a scientist, because that path at that time allowed for kind of, it was just more open. I mean, it allowed for people like her to be recognized and brought in. And there are probably 100 different domains of experience and work and knowledge at this point in history about which, in this country, about which you could say the same thing.
I think that's true. And so timing is very important, and it offers opportunities, and it presents a pathway for lucky people or persistent people, and certainly the curious. I was working for the artists, and I was interested in showing their work the way they wanted it to be seen. The early days on Canyon Road, people came up from Albuquerque for the openings, and I always held my openings a little bit later so that if there were other things going on, people would all gather at the gallery. And I have some images that I'll show Friday at the presentation of the earliest days in the gallery and the crowds and the people who were there. And now there are so many good galleries in this town and so many serious artists that the game has changed, and the questions a gallerist has to ask and answer in order to stay afloat are different than the questions I had to ask and answer. And the same for artists.
Can you describe what some of those differences are?
Well, I think asking the right question is a great way to move ahead and move towards dreams or success. So that if an artist has to know, what do I want out of my career? Do I want to be famous? Do I want to be rich? Do I want to be on the cover of Art News, Art in America? Do I want to have time in the studio? Personally, I was always drawn to those artists whose interest in the studio life was the most important to them. Because if an artist wants to be famous, there are steps one could take to increase the likelihood of that happening. If an artist wants more time in the studio, there are different ways. With regard to galleries, I always ask myself, how can I create a market for what I want to put in the gallery? So I did my best to answer those questions. Some people might say...
And how did you do that?
I wanted to create a reputation for the gallery that this is a place where serious, intellectual, beautiful social things happen. And this is a gallery that pays attention to quality, and I guess that's it. I wanted to make it a center, a place where people would want to come.
And that created the market.
Yes, it did. For example, I did all those ads on The Magazine that weren't advertising an artist. They weren't even advertising an art philosophy so much as a life philosophy. And so for galleries, a gallery has to ask or may decide to ask, you know, how do I make money here? What can I put in the gallery that will sell? Who are my clients? No, to pay attention to what one wants and ask questions that lead in those directions. Now, you know, I ultimately had to close because I ran out of the ability to borrow more money. So I was successful in that I had a gallery that people loved and about which I was always very proud, but not a gallery that was successful in terms of stashing away a lot of money.
So you kind of broke even.
You know, I broke ahead because of where the experiences and the opportunities catapulted me. And so if we were thinking about how did you do financially, I stayed afloat for 30 years, right?
That's a lot.
Right. And when I closed, all my artists were paid, but not my credit cards. I have new ideas of what happens next. And a lot of what I learned from all those years of travel and interaction with remarkable, remarkable artists and collectors are now kind of positioning me for now what? You know, now what?
We're talking to Linda Durham, who also calls herself a freelance cultural explorer. So you were giving a talk. It's called Wonderlust, Linda Durham's 30 Fearless Years in the Art World. And the term fearless, now, do you feel like you were always fearless? Is that a quality that you were able to develop over the years?
In retrospect, I think I was always fearless. That's not to say I wasn't concerned about certain things that happened and that I never had a night where I woke up and thought, oh my God, what's going to happen next? But typically it didn't keep me from doing things. And I've always thought maybe I was also an artist, but I just use other people's artwork and experiences as my medium.
That's actually something I was going to ask you, because sometimes people who are really good gallerists and curators have their own artistic tendencies.
Not in terms of making anything with my hands or not painting. I do love to write. I write a lot. And but I loved curating and creating a show which has its artistic side. And I like doing things, even with the gallery, that people thought, wow, well, that won't work. How can you do that? And something that was important to me all my life was a new adventure. You know, from a childhood running away or checking out things in the woods.
Did you run away?
Oh, yeah. I was a runaway as a child.
You're kidding. What'd you do?
You know, the first time it was just really running towards, because I ran after a puppy. And my parents lost me, and the police eventually found me. But I was one of those kids that threatened to run away and left with teddy bears. And in high school, not so much a runaway, but I skipped school almost every Wednesday and took the bus from Camden, New Jersey, to Manhattan, to the Port Authority terminal. And then I would sneak into the second act of whatever Broadway matinees were running. So I saw the second act of a lot of shows when I was in high school. Well, they did. After a while, sometimes the stage door guards would let me go into the back. But what I would do is wait until people came out at intermission with their little orange juice containers, and I would pick up an orange juice container, and then when everybody walked back into the theater, I would saunter in and wait and see if there was an empty seat. And lots of times there were empty seats. And I always wanted to see the world. I never felt that I was rooted to a particular place or that I couldn't go somewhere else. So now, lo these many years later, and I turned 70 a few months ago, I have been around the world and I have chosen places. You know, I like to fly somewhere, get there, and see what happens. And so I've done that a lot, and never have been disappointed with the places. And, you know, I've never wanted to jump out of an airplane. There are certain kinds of things that aren't attractive to me, but talking with people, showing up somewhere, that kind of fearlessness. I don't know how to be afraid. I know people are afraid of not staying healthy or not having any money. And I've just assumed I will be healthy and the money will follow. I can't recommend that as a way of life for other people.
Right. Well, I mean, everybody... Was it Oscar Wilde who said, be yourself, everyone else is taken?
Yes. It's great.
So, describe that. I mean, you go to some, you decide you're going to go to some new place that you've never been to in a foreign country. You pack your bag, you've got your passport up to date. You fly there, you arrive at the airport. Give it, like, what happens
okay.
then?
Well, once the gallery closed, I thought, now, you know, who am I? Who am I now that I'm not Linda Durham, girl art dealer, which was, you know, my personal name for myself. And it was disconcerting, not fearful, but like, I have a lot I want to do, now what? And so I had always wanted to go around the world. And I didn't want to, you know, I couldn't just do that with lots of money or anything. So I needed to have a project, and this last trip, I planted seeds of peace. I found these small seed-embedded papers that had a picture and a drawing of the earth on one side, and I had friends write wishes or prayers for peace on the other side, and I took them, and I got an around-the-world airplane ticket online, and
those exist.
You
can
just—they do.
I mean, as long as you keep flying west,
yes,
you can get another on the next
yes.
plane.
There are different ways and different ways of doing it. So I wanted to stay warm. I left right before Christmas, and I flew first to Johannesburg, and I spent some time in Soweto, and quite a long time had wanted to go to Lesotho, because until a few years ago, I guess I had never heard of Lesotho.
Tell us about Lesotho.
It's a kingdom that is completely surrounded by South Africa, and it's mountainous. It's remote. It's not a real tourist destination, and to get there. There were no buses. I landed in Johannesburg, but then I didn't want to fly to Lesotho. I wanted to go by road. And so I went the way the people of Lesotho travel, and that was on a minibus where I was the only foreigner, the only non-Lesotho person. And everybody was nice to me. It was a long bus ride. A young man helped me get through customs and got me a driver, and I found a hotel. And pretty soon, I fell in love with Lesotho, and I asked is there an orphanage that I could visit? And I was taken to an orphanage, and I sang at a church service in an orphanage. Nobody spoke English there, and
what do they speak? Do they have their own national language?
Yeah, they have their own language, and some are learning English, but most of them speak. And it's not. It's called like Basutu, but that's not it either.
Yeah.
And so I made a donation at that church, and we planted some seeds, and then they took me in where all the children were, and put me up on the stage, and I didn't know what to do, so it was a Christian church, so I sang Jesus Loves the Little Children, and then I had all these new friends, and then pretty soon, weeks
with whom you
later,
couldn't really fully communicate?
But I could hug them, and you could smile, and we could write, and my driver could translate, and then I went to Madagascar, where I had perhaps one of the most remarkable experiences of my traveling life, where I took another small van from Antananarivo, the capital, to a place where I could see the baobab trees, and which was one of the only places they grow. And I had seen a photograph in a magazine of those trees, and I thought, I want to go there. It was actually the focus of that trip.
And what were they like?
Well, they're tall, and they're in a very remote area, and it was the rainy season, and there was lots of mud. But the adventure was the 18-hour minivan ride over rough, dark roads, where all sorts of adventures happened. And once again, where I was the only foreigner and where I learned some great lessons about myself. For example, you know, the flight from Atlanta to Johannesburg was 15 hours. And I was flying what we might describe as steerage.
Those seats that are about four inches wide.
I had one of the worst seats. But even the worst seats on the Delta Airlines, I had my own little video screen. They gave me food. There was a bathroom. I could get up and stretch. So, and it was grueling. Whereas the 18-hour trip in a minivan, where nobody gave me food, and there's no video screen, I can't watch movies, and there's no bathroom. In fact, there's really no bathroom. There's some shaded area when they stop to get petrol. And that was a remarkable trip. And people said, weren't you afraid? You know, you're talking about fearlessness. No. I knew that I would be safe. And that I was up for whatever adventure would happen, which was...
You knew just out of faith, or...?
I just knew. And years ago, I used to be afraid of flying a little bit, and especially if it was bumpy. And so I invented some ways not to be afraid, because I didn't want it to keep me from flying. So one of the ways was I would close my eyes and imagine I was on a bus. So it wasn't up in the air. You know, and somehow being on a bumpy road and a bus wasn't as disconcerting. And then I had another way that I would look at other people who were going to be on the flight with me, like cute little children or a young, loving couple, and I would say, oh yeah, I can see they have a great life ahead of them, and I'm on the flight with them, and so they're landing and I'm landing. And as years went on, I became the person who calmed other people who were afraid by saying things like, you know, these planes are just made to withstand winds much greater than this. I remember somebody telling me that. Passed it on.
We're talking to Linda Durham. Now, you were talking a moment ago about being in Madagascar and seeing these baobab trees.
Yes.
weren't they kind of mythologized in The Little Prince?
Oui, c'est vrai.
Yeah, okay.
They were, right. So
was that part of the motivation for you?
No, it was coincidental. It really is. I saw a photograph of a beautiful woman standing on this avenue of baobabs, and she was wrapped in some sort of beautiful tapestry, and the light was just perfect, and there was nothing else there. And I simply thought, I want to stand there. And I want my picture taken. Not that I would be the beautiful woman wrapped in the great tapestry, but that I could go there. That to have a challenge like that just appealed to me. And still does, you know. I have my other challenges that I want to do.
What is ahead of you?
Ahead of me is building the Wonder Institute, which was an idea that I started once the gallery closed. And I'm starting a little philanthropic project and writing project. So I want to build the Wonder Institute. And also, and this is just between the two of us, so I hope nobody... No, I'm only joking. My house is in foreclosure. And not because of something that I did wrong, but because of big banks. And so I'm working a lot on the situations that a lot of people are experiencing with regard to banking shenanigans.
Very and interesting and very important.
Really important. And I think a lot of things are coming out. And at first, you know, you'd think I would be reticent to say that. Well, maybe I was slightly reticent. But at first I thought I was ashamed that this was happening to me. But it was happening because of crazy stuff in the banking world. And I didn't want to be afraid of exposing the reality of my life. Because you know what? I love my life. And even if it's about things that aren't all, you know, roses and gold, it's all interesting.
You said at the beginning this little jingle, the world would cease if it were run by people who say it can't be done, something like that.
Yes.
And when I think about things that I would like to do or participate in, the biggest challenge I think that we have and have always had on this earth is peace, is
yes.
figuring out how to solve our problems without horrible brutality and mindless, senseless, crazy, evil, life, society-destroying brutality.
This is so important to me to figure this out or to realize that it maybe I can't make everything wonderful in the world or find the people who can, but I can look for them and I can do my little part, because one could wake up every morning and say, oh my gosh, you know, there's so much wrong, and I care about the climate situation and the deterioration of education in this country and other places, and the problems that women have, and and the food situation and the pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, it's not a short list.
It's not a short list. And so I sign the petitions, and I write the letters, and I stand with the signs, and I'm there. I want to see a better world. And the only thing I can really do is be an optimistic person, a person who doesn't give up, a person who begins to see what is possible, and see if it spreads. I'm writing a book called Still Moving, and and that's it.
Is there a little oxymoron in there?
I guess there could be. I mean, there's stillness and there's movement and there's the fact that after all this, I'm still moving. But I put a slash between the two words.
Right, right. We're talking to Linda Durham. Now, when you were doing the art gallery for all those 30 years, you accumulated and probably were very good at saving all your records and correspondence and catalogs and so on. And you have recently given that to the New Mexico Museum of Art.
I have. I was an accidental archivist, and I saved all kinds of things. And when the gallery closed and I moved everything to my house, I had a complete garage or garage and a half filled with boxes of photographs, correspondence, invitations, small artworks, drawings that artists made for me for various birthdays. And I spoke with Laura Addison and Joe Traugott early on. Is this something the museum would want? And they said yes. So they both came to my house, and we looked at some things, and then we set a date. And Laura came with two of her assistants, and I had another assistant help me, and five of us went through box after box after box. And
what was that like?
It was kind of wonderful, because all short stories came out of like, oh, really, this is Rosalind Constable a long time ago. And she was the avant-garde arts reporter for Time Life and had a great collection, and she was a friend of mine, and we talked about that. Or then, oh, this is when you went to Scotland, or this is an early set of photographs of the shows in Chicago. And so it was kind of fun. Some of it made me very dizzy, you know, to go through. There must have been over 5,000 photographs. And for this particular presentation, Laura picked out about 150 images that she thought might be interesting to show, and then we just pared them down, so I think maybe there's 50 or 60. And so they showed the beginning of the gallery all the way up until, I think the last shot is a shot of my house, which is also known as the Wonder Institute. And so many stories came out about the people who helped make this an exciting art world, not just for the historic work or the landscape, the Taos founders, the Cinco Pintores, but the people who came after, and many of whom are still here, and some of whom we've lost through the years.
Yeah. What was it like to let go of that? I mean, at a certain point, you go through the boxes, and then they're gone.
Yes, and we organized things so that even the process of going through the boxes, there were a few things I thought, you know, I'm not ready to let go of that. And then, here's this, nobody's ever going to want to know about this. So there are also about, you know, 15 giant garbage bags of things that went to the landfill. They're long gone now, right? That the museum didn't want and I had no use for. And then I don't know how many banker's boxes, but a truckload of banker's boxes went to the museum. And I still have more work that I plan to give to the museum, but I didn't want to. A lot of things are still hanging on my wall, and a lot of things inspire me day after day. I'm not ready to let go of them, but they would belong in the museum. A few things, you know.
Is there going to be some kind of show at some point of the work that you gave them?
Not that I know of, but I think I still would have to give them more artwork to make it
to go
a
with
good show.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, do you want to see? I have a I think the museum may have this now, or it's still in some of my files. For example, an old note from Forrest Fenn at the very beginning of my so-called career. At the top of it, it's his interoffice stationery. It says, "From the cluttered mind of Forrest Fenn." And then he drew a kind of Picasso-esque face, and he wrote on it, "Do unto others, then bug the hell out." So that's it. That deserves to be framed. And or maybe it should go in his treasure chest.
Right, wherever that is. Wherever. Everybody wants to know.
Yes, I doubt that anyone will find it in our lifetime.
I've been thinking recently about the question of what you can teach other people and be taught by other people on the one hand, and what you have to just figure out for yourself on the other. It sounds like you pretty much figured it all out by yourself, a lot of it out by yourself.
I didn't. I mean, I figured a lot out by myself, and I think in the end that's true, because you may get a lot of information and choose to put it into practice or not, or to pay attention. And so I found out that paying attention was a really good slogan for me. And what I've figured out so far is that it's like my life, your life is yours, that you're responsible for the direction it takes. And if you're quiet and pay attention, what do I want to do? What do I want to make of my life? For me, it's I wanted access, and by access I meant to information, to individuals, to worthwhile causes, to adventure, to insight, and to opportunity for more access.
And all of that is still an ongoing process.
It is indeed.
Linda Durham is an art gallerist, longtime art gallery owner, freelance cultural explorer, and tomorrow night at 5:30, she will be at the St. Francis Auditorium, which is at the New Mexico Museum of Art, and giving a talk called Wonderlust, Linda Durham's 30 Fearless Years in the Art World. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.